Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is writer David Gessner. He is the Kenyon Distinguished Professor in Creative Writing at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. And tonight we're talking about Return of the Osprey, a season of flight and wonder, the 25th anniversary edition that just came out. David, welcome back to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, sir. It's great to be back again, after all.
This is a weird experience for me, David, because although I reread fiction, I don't really reread a lot of nonfiction. And we did an interview about this book 25 years ago.
Yeah.
For me, it was a fascinating experience as rereading this book. And there were things that you wrote about that have affected me all these decades. Your description of the osprey nest has really stuck with me, and I now look closely at every single osprey nest to see what material is in there.
To see if you see a naked Barbie,
doll. It's
like I did.
Yeah, and I haven't. But
we should explain to listeners that ospreys, though beautiful and athletic, are not neatniks, and they tend to jam everything they can find into these huge nests, including Easter tinsel and boat line and plastic, and in one case, a Barbie doll.
What was amazing, though, is that ospreys are now nesting in Worcester County, and so you look at these nests, and they're actually mostly not that. They don't have a lot of odd materials, because I think on the coast, there's all sorts of stuff that's thrown away and lying around and washed up on the shore.
Right.
But here, it's mostly sticks.
Well, I'm glad that Worcester ospreys are neat.
I want to talk to you about this book because it was, I think, your really huge breakthrough book. Would you consider it that?
Yeah, I would say, I work with graduate students a lot now, and a lot of those first books they're working on are either short stories or essay collections. And even though my first two books were kind of cohesive, they were essay collections with university presses, and which is what led to Return of the Osprey.
And we actually interviewed about those early books, and that's how I got to recognize you as an author.
Right. I think there was some Worcester in the first book.
Yeah, there was. First of all, I was shocked. But you describe it, and there's a really great introduction to this 25th anniversary edition, where you talk about what happened to you sort of afterwards and how you think about this book. You call it an unsettled book. Why?
Well, I think that the tradition I was working in, from Thoreau, obviously, but, in modern times, Wendell Berry, has a whole notion of there's something settled about nature writing in the literal sense, in that people are finding their homes and places. Robert Finch, the Cape Cod nature writer, said the first flush of rootedness can't be repeated. The excitement of finding home and kind of drilling down into that place. But there is an aspect of that, too, that's a little sanctimonious sometimes, I feel. Like Wendell Berry talks about marrying a place. And he's
right.
Had the good fortune of being married to his farm in Kentucky most of his life. Not all of us have that good fortune. I had written my book about loving Cape Cod while I was in Colorado, and turned around and written my book about loving Colorado while on Cape Cod. And ultimately, as I say in that introduction, by saying at the end of Return of the Osprey, I will stay forever on Cape Cod, I end up getting a job in North Carolina as a professor because someone's read the book. And at that moment in my life, my wife is pregnant, and suddenly health insurance and a salary seem like a good idea.
Yeah, reality steps in.
So my question has been not, how do I stay in one place, but how do I be in movement? And a line from a great poet, A.R. Ammons, he's writing about beechgrass, but it applies to life. And he says, firm ground is not available ground. And that was kind of my senses. Can I have a good life? Admiring all these writers who are doing the same thing, but where I'm where I'm unsettled.
You are really unsettled in Return of the Osprey.
Yes.
And home, the sense of home, the being at home, reflected in the nesting of the ospreys, but also yourself. You had had a testicular cancer diagnosis. Your father had passed away, and your father's grave features prominently in the Return of the Osprey. There really was a quest of trying to find meaning in where you were.
Yeah, I was in my late 30s. I'd been in Colorado for 6 years, where I met my wife. We came back to the Cape thinking we were going to promote my first book for however long, a couple months, and ended up staying 6 years. And in the course of that time, it really, you know, we've talked about it before. I'd written Sick of Nature.
First of all, I still love that book. I still love that collection of essays.
But I was just kind of, by saying Sick of Nature, I was just trying to say, I'm not a nature writer. I'm not.
Well, you were really rebelling against it.
I was. And it actually started as an essay, not a book. And an editor read it and got in touch from Algonquin Books and got in touch with me. And the irony was she asked me to do a nature book because within Sick of Nature, I'd written about birds. And she said, you write beautifully about birds. I'd love for you to do a book about birds. And I was like, well, I don't want to do a book about, you know, some impalmated plover or a flicker or something. And then I remembered that the ospreys, you know, here I was on Cape Cod and the ospreys were back and I was back from cancer. And they'd never been there when I was young. And I said to her, I could do a book about ospreys. And then she did something extraordinary that no one had ever done before. She gave me an advance, not a big advance, but enough to quit my job at the bookstore, buy a Bushnell Space Master telescope, and go out on the marshes in March. My birthday is March 15th, which is about when the ospreys returned to Cape Cod from South America. And I go out to the marsh and wait for their return. And I picked out four nests and watched them. So it was a life changer, you know, to have that moment. And then I was like, screw it. I guess I am a nature writer. Obviously I read about a lot of different things in the book, but it is really rooted in the journals I kept and the observation of that year, which was new for me. And it actually became, and I'm sorry to go on, but it became kind of a template for how I've written the rest of my book since, which is a kind of enforced patience where I had to sit there and observe because I couldn't write about it until the birds left in September and let it build up. And then when the birds did leave, I blasted that draft out in a month because it had been building up at me for 6 months.
What was the first draft like?
It was a lot like the book, but more memoir, more, you know, as my editor probably would have said, a little too much David Gessner, a little too little Osprey, you know, and at which, you know, which I do tend to err in that direction. And subsequent drafts are kind of paring me back. Because I had a lot of Osprey to work with. Early on, to go with the patience thing, early on, I sought out Alan Poole, who was kind of my Obi-Wan
Kenobi.
During the Osprey year. And Alan said, you've got to learn to live on Osprey time. So when I was sitting out there at the marsh, I really did try to slow myself down. I failed spectacularly at first when I think I have one scene where I'm timing how long I can patiently look at the nest. And I think I've done it 10 minutes and I look down and, you know, 5 minutes had passed or something. But gradually, I got a little better at it, you know, and I watched as the birds started to rebuild the nest and as they incubated the eggs and then ultimately as the nestlings were hatched, which was awesome. You know, it was like I remember writing about or just getting riveted by before writing about it. The mother would tear into the fish and then delicately, delicately place it in the young's mouth. And I said that's a marriage of the savage and the delicate that I loved. And it seemed central to what I was trying to do aesthetically too.
I'm not far off from saying when reading the book a second time, it was better. I think that's because I've experienced more and aged more and I really appreciated it. I think the first time I was trying to glom on the Osprey stuff And right. And then I really realized how much of you is in this book, a lot. And it's that tint, you write about this in the introduction, the tension between looking outward and inward. And that seems to me what's best about your writing overall.
Yeah, you know, thank you very much. I mean, it's been a, going back to the thing about Sick of Nature, I mean, I really do feel like...
Well, first of all, I was totally attracted to the title, I have to say, because I thought it was such a ballsy move to write a book like that.
Well, yeah. Well, one guy, I wrote a piece for the New York Times Book Review early on about how I hated becoming a teacher, and I felt like I had been tagged and put in a zoo. I was no longer... And when the guy asked me to do it, he said, this might be career suicide for, you know, a burgeoning academic, but something tells me you won't say no. He knew that I had that self-destructive impulse along with the creative one. And so, and it, you know, of course, it didn't turn into anything bad, but it's just like, yeah. So Sick of Nature was that, not wanting to, but I'm so glad that it turned out that the natural world, even when I was writing about human interaction, became my subject, because it did give me an outward look. And I quote John Hay, the great Cape Cod nature writer, at the end, when he says, how strange to have come through the century and find that the most interesting thing is birds. Or maybe it's not birds, it's just human beings are more interested when they're looking beyond themselves.
I thought that was a great quote in the book.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things that instantly... this point in my life really, really resonates. The other thing that this book is a great snapshot of Cape Cod at that time.
Yeah. You were just mentioning the migrations. And when I first moved to Cape in like 83 for living down there during the off season, you know, you had those millions of bird migrations coming through, blackening the sky sometimes. And by the time I'm writing this book, it's reduced somewhat, but, you know, we're only going in one direction, unfortunately.
Yeah, there's no going back.
Yeah.
There's an interesting sense of the Cape itself and the people and the vacationers. It hasn't quite built up to the fever pitch that it is now. You know, it's still sort of, you can still find those places on the Cape, like all the creeks that you kayaked in and stuff like that. But that's harder and harder to find today.
Well, you can also find time of year, right? I mean, I've regularly been visiting the third week of October, which was always my...
Yeah, but everybody's caught on to that period of time.
Well, that's pretty late in October. It's getting colder.
See, what's happened is when you wrote Return of the Osprey, it was like people hadn't really, really a lot of them discovered the Cape in October.
Right.
Now you want to head to November.
Yeah, exactly.
It's become really, really popular now.
COVID didn't help either.
No. Well, that's another story entirely. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight, and it is always a pleasure to talk to him, is writer David Gessner. He's the Keenan Distinguished Professor in Creative Writing at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. And we're talking about Return of the Osprey, A Season of Flight and Wonder, the 25th anniversary edition. Just reading that made me feel old. But that's the other thing. There were some cool digressions about muskrats and stuff like that in your book, too. And I grew to realize that that's what I also appreciate about your writing, your little sort of spin-offs and writing about them. You know what? I should ask you an obvious question, if people don't realize this already. Why choose an osprey as opposed to a muskrat?
Well,
it seems obvious to me, and it's obviously obvious to you, but...
Well, also, some people listening might not really know,
you know,
that, you know, an osprey is a big athletic raptor. Like, if you think of eagles as the centers, they're the power forwards, ospreys. And it's got a black mask. It's a beautiful bird that has a bend at the carpus in the wing. And it's, you know, its signature move is hovering far above the water, spying a fish, and then diving down headfirst before popping a wheelie and going in and grabbing a fish. And it's specifically, you know, evolved talons that can, you know, the back one can face backwards so it can clutch the fish, lifting off and shaking off like a wet dog. And, you know, and it was an athlete, like unlike, say, a bald eagle, which can be kleptoparasitic and comes and bullies and tries to get the osprey fish that it caught, it catches its own.
Yes. You know?
So it always appealed to me. The athleticism did. I mentioned already sloppiness. My dad called me Dirty Dave as a kid, so I had a kinship with that. Seeming fierce loyalty that they had, and the crazy migrations where the adults in September head south, and then the young somehow, you know, in some internal instincts, they fly south to South America on their own. So just that, you know, it seemed dramatic, and it was. And
well,
go ahead.
There's one other aspect, though. They were almost wiped out of Massachusetts.
Yes, and that's a huge part of that. We were down to 10 nests in Massachusetts in, like, 1970. And by the time I was watching, there were over, you know, between 300 and 400. And now there are many more. So by day, I would go out and watch ospreys because I had that money from the advance. But by night, I would read ospreys. And a quote I've returned to again and again in my book is John Muir's, "When you pick up one thing in the universe, you find it hitched to everything else." And I certainly found ospreys hitched to everything. And in reading and interviewing people, I realized that they were there. Ospreys were there at basically the birth of environmental law. Some folks on Long Island, inspired by Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, got together in the late 60s, early 70s, and fought against the spraying of DDT on their marshes there. What DDT was doing was killing the insects, which the fish were eating, which the ospreys were eating. And the ultimate effect on ospreys was it thinned their eggs. So when the mothers incubated the eggs, or sometimes the fathers, they crushed their young, and so they were being wiped out by it. So these guys got together, and they ended up suing the local mosquito commission, and they won. And they won other cases, and they had a new motto, which was "Sue the Bastards." And ultimately, DDT was outlawed in a few states, and then in 1972, it was outlawed nationally by the EPA. So it's, you know, it was just amazing to me that this story that I hadn't planned on going in this direction was there at kind of the birth of environmentalism and environmental law. So that was exciting. And then on a more writerly note, I realized that if I just wrote a factual book about ospreys, which had already been done brilliantly by my friend Alan Poole, but if I wrote it, just said only what I saw, I would bore people to death.
Right.
So as I was out there at the marsh, I was taking notes, but I also was thinking about making outlines and chapter outlines. And I realized by making myself a character in the book, and who was ignorant of ospreys, which I was, I'd never seen an osprey dive. I got them confused with gulls at first, but who gets more and more obsessed and learns about them, the reader could come along for the ride and learn about them too, but also learn about the excitement of getting obsessed and getting into it and getting into the natural world. And I think there was one point in the book, and I can't remember which month, where I'm walking out to a nest and somebody's coming back with kind of a gleam in his eyes. And I want to say, "Have you found ospreys too?" So, you know, I wouldn't say religious, but there was something going on there in terms of my immersion in ospreys.
You become a birder throughout the book too.
You know, gradually over the years, having hung out with a lot of good birders, I'd say I'm okay now. I've never been a great one. My ears aren't great, though of course Merlin is helping dramatically on that. People who know the Merlin app, suddenly you're hearing things and being able to see things you never did before. I'm a good birder, but or a pretty good birder.
That's all it takes, as long as you're out there looking.
Yeah, and that's a big part of the book too, is you don't have to, you know, I talked to some students about it recently, and I was like, look, don't be a perfectionist with your journals or anything like that. Just note everything. You know, I called my journal my swill bin because I could draw cartoons in it, things to do lists, and take notes on the ospreys. Like, you know, free yourself up by not being a perfectionist.
I love the interactions between you and Alan Poole, because often he's sort of the hard-headed ornithologist who really dismisses a lot of your sort of semi-flaky writer poetic stuff and realize it's really just this.
I don't know if it's you're kind of coming in and out all of a sudden.
Okay.
But I will say that our interactions, I never wrote this at the time or even thought it until now, but it had a little bit of a Mr. Spock and Captain Kirk feel to it.
Now that you bring that up, that's really true.
Yeah.
He just wanted the facts.
And let's just say I wasn't Spock.
But the other thing, and we talked about this off mic, to capture that palpable melancholy of the Cape in fall, I realized how special that was a part of the book as I reread it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because, I mean, it's kind of an obvious thing, but these birds who have made life so dramatic, and, you know, I've watched them, I've watched the young learn how to fly, I've watched them feed their young, I've watched, suddenly they leave. So, you know, it's gone. And so this big part of the place has gone away for another 6 months. Crazy. And by the end, you know, I think by the end of summer, my wife was ready for me to move on to something else. She'd heard a lot about ospreys. And there was one scene where, which really happened, but a scene in the book too, is I'm out on the back deck, and I've gone up to the fish market and gotten a fish, and I'm ripping it apart with pliers. My wife thinks or claims I was wearing a loincloth, but I don't own any loincloth. It was a bathing suit, not a loincloth. I was ripping them apart, and she just kind of rolled her eyes, like, kind of, enough is enough.
Channeling the osprey.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing that happened, and you write about this, is that you became an environmentalist. Although you resisted the term from the beginning, you write that you finally had no choice but to take action.
Yeah, well, you know, it's always been a kind of thing where teaching, which is something I do, and which I wasn't doing as much then, but I was running up to teach at like Harvard Extension School even during that year, and writing, which I commit a lot of time to every day, just felt sometimes like these were opposite. You know, getting out there and going to meetings and giving talks felt like opposite. And it felt like, I already do enough. Please don't make me do more. But my conscience and my experience pushed me to do more, you know, and to talk about it. And I actually, if you don't mind, I can say how that is what's going on right now with ospreys, which is, we are in the midst, not planned at all in terms of my book's release a month ago, but ospreys are now in the midst of another crisis after having had a roaring comeback and, you know, thousands and thousands of nests, not just on the East Coast, but you mentioned in Worcester and in Colorado.
Well, they have only returned to Worcester because of the increase of ospreys on the coast.
Yes. And so it's been a great success and one of the few hopeful environmental stories. But in the last couple of years, overfishing, industrial fishing Menhaden, and Menhaden are one of the chief sources of osprey food, and also they're two or three times more energy packed than most fish. So it's not just that they catch a lot of them, but when they do, it provides a lot of bang for its buck. Well, there's a group, a company called Omega Protein in Virginia, and they have fished out basically the menhaden. And, of course, what starts in Virginia doesn't stay in Virginia. It goes up to Maryland and Delaware. But now, in the last couple of years, we're getting low numbers in southern Jersey, and even New England numbers have dropped. And in the Chesapeake, the numbers have fallen to DDT-level reproduction. Yeah. You know, these nestlings are starving. And it's very directly connected to this overfishing for menhaden. So the good news for me, there's two bits of good news. One is we have the example of what happened back in DDT, and we know that if we fight, we can help the Ospreys rebound. And two is the union, or the combo of hunters, fishermen, and environmentalists. You see the people fighting to shut down the Menhaden fishery are, you know, you've got Audubon, but you also have got these hunting and fishing organizations. And I think overall, even though it's a very dismal environmental time, that's a hopeful moment. That's how the public lands provision was kicked out of the Big Beautiful Bill, because you didn't just have environmentalists, you had hunter outdoors people, you know. And so, I don't know, those two things are there, and I'm hoping that it's outlawed. I'm hoping this industrial fishing, you know, where they catch millions of tons of menhaden.
It's the same story is true for things like horseshoe crabs.
Yes.
And we can't get into it. We're completely out of time, but I do want to mention the quote from Return of the Osprey, 277. I have a complicated relationship with hope. That's you. So it was fascinating to hear you say the word hope several times in this last couple of minutes.
Well, there's a quote from Samuel Johnson, without hope, there is no endeavor.
So and that lets
a little false hope sometimes. It's fuel.
Okay. And on that, that's a great note to end on. My returning guest tonight is writer David Gessner. He's the Keenan Distinguished Professor of Creative Writing at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. And we've been talking about Return of the Osprey, a season of flight and wonder, the 25th anniversary edition. And I really felt it was worthwhile rereading this book. So, David, hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure. It's been great to do it in the 25 years since the book came out.
I know.
On other books.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.